Cognitive Rampage podcast. Today's guest, I am honored and thrilled to have in the cave with us, Jiu-Jitsu black belt and American top team fighter and coach, Paul Rodriguez. He has a resume of fighting that is too long for an intro here. We talk about his story coming into it being a traditionalist, one of the first Americans to receive a black belt. We talk about his training, his views on fighting versus the sport. He makes that separation, which I thought was brilliant. But we talk for about an hour and a half about all aspects. We talk about the philosophy of coaching versus the philosophy of fighting. We talk about fighting today or the sport today versus fighting 10 years ago. He talks a lot about his experience coaching and as a fighter, what he sees happening and changing in the sport today. But he didn't hold anything back. I really enjoyed finally getting to talk to Paul Rodriguez. He had been suggested many times by many people. And he took some time out of his day and came over to the cave today from the gym, American Top Team. So shout out to them. We get a lot of love out to a lot of people in this podcast. As he talks about, it takes a great team to make a great champion. But I hope you enjoy. It was an honor and a pleasure to talk to my friend, Paul Rodriguez. Thank you for coming by, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. I'm glad to be here.
You have come more than once advised to me to have you on the show. It's been, let's see, first Julian Williams. He was on the episode. He was actually episode number four. He was the first season last year.
Right.
He came on and he talked about you. And then Jason Capolucci, he told me, and his friend Danny McNamara.
Gotcha.
Who knows Jason, told me to have you come on. It just was one after another, man.
Right, right. I'm glad people are recommending me and stuff like that, you know. Like, so I'm here to contribute, get this thing going. Let's go.
Well, I got to imagine you have probably, the way everybody's been talking to me, how many black belts have you handed out?
It's funny. I've only handed out three.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean.
Okay. You hoard that thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm a traditionalist. I'm one of the first generation Americans to get their black belt. In the sense that I started before jiu-jitsu was really even here. So I mean, some of the changes in it. I mean, it's bound to happen. But I'm sticking to, you know, if you're not a legit badass, You're not gonna get your belt, you know, and everything that comes with that. You gotta be a good dude and everything too, but I mean, you gotta be, you know.
When you say a traditionalist and you were one of the first ones to get a black belt, take me back there. What was that like? or what was the time set? You know what I mean? What was it like here? What was jiu-jitsu like as you entered, you know?
Well, like when I mean I'm one of the first generation guys, I don't mean I'm one of the first guys in America to get my black belt as American, but what I mean is, when I started training jiu-jitsu, there was no American black belts yet. The art had just come to the United States. I mean, it had been here for a while, but it wasn't on the map yet. Obviously, the UFC.
What time frame are we talking?
I was introduced to jiu-jitsu in 1996 through the Ultimate Fighter. A friend of mine showed me a video, and that's where I saw it. That's where I first introduced to Hoist Gracie. Obviously, a lot of people know who the guy is, but he's what I mean, the first Ultimate Fighter. I remember Dean Thomas, he's the guy I'm talking about, brought over some VHS tapes and...
VHS. For those of you young ones listening to the podcast, see, VHS is a large tape that used to have actual tape, okay, that recorded things.
So this was in late 96, and these tapes were, you know, like the first UFC was in 1993. So he brought these over, and it was the coolest thing. There was these no-holes-barred fights with no weight limits, no time limits. And this little skinny Brazilian guy was choking out these big guys, these big monsters. And I thought it was the coolest thing. So me and him started, you know, watching tapes and training. And, I mean, we actually sought out better training, but that's what I mean by that. There wasn't any. At the time, there was a black belt in Miami who just came, Conan Silveria. And then actually Marcio Simas here in Orlando. But they were pretty much the only two black belts in the Southeast when we first started training. So definitely a different generation, different time back then when we first started training.
I mean, you really are a pioneer in this, man.
Yeah, I mean, I started, like I said, I'm one of the first, I think, you know, I'm not, like I said, we were one of the first guys to actually start training. And like I said, there was nobody was doing it. I mean, we were just trying to explain it to people.
Okay. It's almost like you see it everywhere now, right?
There's, oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt. And it's a little different now. Yeah, and obviously the sport's gotten bigger, you know, and the UFC actually helped that a lot by getting it bigger and stuff. But even inside the gyms, it's a little different. I would say, you know, 17, 18 years ago, guys who trained jiu-jitsu wanted to be they're training because they wanted to be a badass. They wanted to be able to fight, to handle themselves, or they wanted to fight in the UFC. They wanted to fight professionally. Nowadays, you know, and I own a gym, and you know, 9 out of 10 people that come in just want to get in shape and have a hobby. You know, that didn't exist back then. You know, that shit just didn't exist.
Now,
yeah.
Now, what's that really do for you? Because I have no comparison here at all. The only comparison I really have is like this DJ time where I was spinning records, and then all of a sudden CDJs came out and everyone was a DJ. Like, right. you there was no skill anymore. You matched numbers, and so I quit. So Is that kind of like what you witnessed? Is it was like this specialty thing, you needed skills, and then it was like, it's just this.
Yeah, well, I mean, as the market increased, you know, obviously people wanted to make it more, that's so everyone can do it and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, you know, like as long as you're not lying to your customers, you know, and your students and stuff, as long as you're not getting them, you know, just a little bit of that out there. But so it's not necessarily nothing wrong with it. It was just different. Like I said, like, 15 years ago, everybody on the mat was training to fight. Now it's like, I don't want to go hard tonight and stuff like that. And I'm not saying one way is right or wrong or better or worse, but
you point out the difference.
Yeah, it was a huge difference back then. You know, everybody was, so the training was a lot harder. You know, obviously the best guys today in jiu-jitsu are better than the best guys from back then. But on average, you know, I don't think that's the case. You know, I think guys were a little bit more tougher back then. You know, if you take your average guys and stuff. So, that's what I mean by when I say I'm still kind of a traditionalist. You know, I've only given out, you know, 3 black belts, and I've been doing this a long time. And
what's the name of your gym and your school?
I'm affiliated with American Top Team, so I run one of the academies here in Orlando, American Top Team Orlando. And
that's all you ever see. I swear to God, every UFC fight I see is coming out of American Top Team.
Yeah, they're obviously one of the best fight teams in the country, but, I mean, they're definitely the biggest. If you go, like, if you look at their roster and people they have in shows, you know, they're definitely the biggest. In fact, I mean, I'm not probably the best thing to say, but sometimes I don't even know. Like, I'll look on, this guy trains at American Top Team too, you know. So, it is what it is. But yeah, it's definitely like one of the bigger teams, you know, for sure.
Now I want to get personal, right? We'll kind of get through the soft stuff, you know, that we're talking about jiu-jitsu. We'll probably definitely circle back there, but you know, I want to know your story, man. Walk me in Paul Rodriguez head from little to how you grew up to give me your life story, man, and how it came to be here. And I'll interrupt you a few times along the way, I'm sure, to throw us off course. So,
right. Well, I was born in San Antonio, Texas. Time my family was living in Chicago, so that's where my brothers and sisters were from. So my parents, you know, they met really young. They had, you know, a bunch of kids when they were really young, so we kind of bounced around.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have three. So I mean, there was 4 of us, but there was 4 of us by, my parents were 22, you know, it was 4 of us by, yeah. So, okay. So I mean, it was a little different. So we bounced around a little bit. We, you know, we were in Chicago for a little bit, and we moved to South Florida, and I've lived in Fort Lauderdale and just kind of migrated my way up till, you know, I ended up going to high school in Port St. Lucie, and that's pretty much where I still consider home. That's where I started training. That's where, you know.
So. Yeah. Funny, I've actually lived in Port St. Lucie. I really did. I opened up a club there a short time called Element.
Okay.
And I was there for a very brief time. I was right by the PGA golf course over there.
Gotcha.
It was such a small town.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. It's a little different now. It's definitely, like, when we were there, it was really small, you know.
I can imagine.
96, yeah. Like, back then, it was really small, you know. So, it's definitely gotten a little bigger. But, you know, growing up, I played football and baseball and stuff like that. Just what most kids do, you know. And then after high school, you know, I started college, and I started off at Indian River, came up here to go to UCF and got my BA. But that's when I started watching, you know, in between then I was, you know, training as much as I was studying.
When did you first start training?
97 per se, you know, like 97, we, you know, I was introduced, not, I mean, 96, in 96, we were in the front yard, we were in the, you know, in the living room, we were grappling, we were trying to study tapes, and I remember we were, I'll never forget the day we were watching Oleg Tektarov do a rolling knee bar, and we thought it was the coolest thing, and we're trying to do it in the living room, you know, moving coffee tables and stuff, so, I mean, but it wasn't until 97, like I said, there wasn't much, too many places to train around then, back then, so we found a Japanese shoot fighting school who was affiliated with Bart Vail. And Bart Vail is like an old Japanese wrestler. He did, you know, Muay Thai, tough guy. Really like dirty submissions, not much technique, not much positioning. But so we learned some basics there, and then it wasn't, you know,
front yard training. But how did you seek that? How did you seek, how did you find them? Where were they at?
We were searching. I mean, and this guy, the guy who taught it was only affiliated with Bart Vail. So he was, you know, he was more of a Kenpo karate guy. I mean, that's how sparse it was back then. So, but he did have a little bit of knowledge of the grappling. So it was only the first, you know, 12, 15 months we were there. But like I said, everybody was so new. Everybody was so new back then. So, I mean, it was what it was, you know, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to live through, you know, is kind of going back there. I can see you guys out on the grind going, oh, well, where do we go? Where do right. we train? Who do we learn from?
Right, right. And that's why, you know, I mean, there was some pros and cons to that when we were learning. We didn't learn much. We didn't learn a lot. But what we learned, we got really, really good at and stuff. And that's a little bit of the critique today is that there's just so much out there. People, like, you know, they're learning so fast. It's more, you know, they're not learning the – so – people won't ever really learn anything, but they kind of have an idea of a lot of little stuff in jiu-jitsu, but they don't ever really, you know, so if we knew two guard passes, that's all we knew, and there was nowhere, you know, until we actually ordered some VHS tapes and or went to a seminar, we weren't learning anything else, you know.
So, who's doing seminars at the time?
Back then, I went to a house, basically the Gracies, because they had the big name back then, so I remember going to a Half Gracie seminar in, like, 98, and I was, you know, I saw him do a umoplata, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world, you know, and then I went to a Cross and Gracie seminar, who one of the founders of Jiu-Jitsu, you know, he's arguably one of the biggest names, you know, his 10-year anniversary of his death was yesterday, actually, so I remember meeting him back in 99 and stuff like that, so, but we'd go there and pick up everything we could and come back and practice, and that's, you know, so, I mean, it was good. I definitely see the value in that now, you know, as opposed to some of my blue belts who are, you know, got it. They're always learning new stuff, and they're not really mastering what they knew. But, you know, so it's a little tricky now, you know.
So what you're saying is, you know, you can take on so much information and so much knowledge so quickly that you never really master the foundation.
Yeah. And it's tricky as, you know, there's you know, as an instructor, it's tricky because if you stay on the same thing for too long, they're your students, but they'll also be very bored. They're also customers as well. So it's tricky. You have to find that fine line. If it was a volunteer team, like, you know, most sports are in high school and stuff, where you're like, you're doing this or get out, you know. I'll tell you, every instructor in the country would train different. You would spend months on you know, but it's a little different because it's a consumer-based thing now too. And, you know, you're trying to find to mix that between teach them the best and practical way.
It seems, you know, like you would almost dilute the practice doing
that.
That's
a little bit. And it's a little tricky, too, because it's you know, and I'll be honest, guys who are like, once again, we were talking about like the people who I just want to get in shape and the hobbyists, they only come in twice a week. They just want to go. They just want to train live. They just want to grapple. They don't really, you know, like, you know, they don't really care to drill. They don't really care. So they're only getting in 2 hours a week, so they want to get more live time and stuff. So that's, you know, and to a certain degree, I understand that because that's what makes jiu-jitsu fun.
It's the business. It's fun.
It's what you're doing. It's you like to grapple. I understand that, but it's not necessarily the best way to see improvement faster. You know, so it's tricky as instructors. You know, and you tell them you got to do this. You got to learn your techniques. You got to, you know.
And they're like, entertain me.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, a lot of it's like that. You know, I mean, they just want to get to the grappling part. You know, so. But if you stay on the same thing too long, which they might not have mastered yet,
and so you're really doing them injustice.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So it's tricky, you know, and that's kind of the dilemma. And
and there's a lot of honor, respect, and pride in martial arts. You know, and has been. I took Ishinryu karate young, right. Coming up maybe 10 years, and my brother went all the way to black belt in Ishinryu.
Right.
And it was very stoic. a lot. You know, it was his black belt was not easy to get. It was long time. It wasn't where they just, hey, you've been here 6 weeks, buy the belt and move on up. You know, it was a guy's garage, Sensei Bassa.
Right.
And so I kind of grew up with that honor, respect idea. And so when I hear you talk, and I think I can only imagine you being a master level that you are, respecting and loving it for so long,
right?
Having to go, you can't go to level two yet. I know it may be boring, but
right. Yeah, you have to, you know, you haven't mastered your foundations yet, you know? So, it's tricky. It really is, you know, but I have a great group of people where I'm at, you know, and I introduce these concepts early on, you know, like I didn't historically always do that. You know, sometimes, you know, as over the years, I've become a better instructor and, you know, obviously with experience that comes, but, right now, I can say I finally beat this concept into their head the day they walk in the door, you know, like, you know, so.
The love that you have from the people you train is ridiculous, like we covered in the beginning. So, you know, whatever style you're using, I mean, you're implanting in these guys' spirits, man.
Right. I appreciate that, you know, and I try to do that, you know, like, you know, when they come in and tell them I'm doing this for a reason, you know, I'm looking out for your best interest and stuff like that. You know, I'm not
a lot of just, trust there, it seems.
Yeah. And that's the biggest thing. And in the long term, that's the most important thing, you know, to probably any relationship ever. But yeah, I mean, definitely between student and teacher, you know, they don't trust you. It's just, you know,
yeah.
So
I gotta imagine it's gotta be building that trust over time, especially when you're trying to entertain them, give them what they want, but then having them have to just let go.
Right. Yeah. And that's what it is. You know, you're trying to build that trust. You're also trying to, give them the best possible training, but you have to, I mean, at a certain point, you know, they're paying to be there. They want to learn, but they're also, you know, like I said, it's a different generation than it was 20 years ago. I mean,
well, yeah. Is it? Well, you know what? Is it true? Is there a wussification of America happening, Paul?
Yeah, I would say yes. Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, like, it's definitely eked into my sport and my martial art a little bit. But yeah, I think in America in general, yeah, I think that's, you know, that's definitely there.
It seems to be, man. And, I, you know, a lot of the parents are creating those monsters, right. You know, and I don't think they mean to. You know, I think a lot of parents are trying to, like, provide a life they didn't have, you know, and work hard,
right.
Make their kids not have to stress.
Right.
And that's great. Right. But where's that fine line between now the kid doesn't even know how to, like, look for something.
Right. Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, I don't see it. I don't have kids. I'm not around kids too much. I mean, we have a small program at our school, but I'm, you know,
you train a lot of adults. Is that where you stay?
Yeah. 99.5.
Well, you're training professional fighters mainly.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I train mostly adults. I mean, you always hear this thing, you got to have kids to make money in martial arts and this and that. And that may or may not be true. I kudos to everyone out there doing it, but.
You seem to be doing okay.
Yeah. You got to do what you really love to do, you know. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to, you know, training kids and teaching kids and stuff. And the kids we have right now, they're
well, I gotta imagine starting little. In 10 years, you got to be a beast. Eddie Bravo was talking about his 10th Planet guys. He had these young boys come in that were a breakdancing team. And then he said that he's never seen anyone pick up on jiu-jitsu faster than these young breakdancing kids.
Right. Yeah, I could believe that. I mean, my girl recently got into that probably about a year ago, and, you know, she's going to the clubs at UCF and learning all this stuff and stuff. But I'm watching the movement she's doing, you know, and I'm trying to mimic them a little bit. I mean, you have to train hard to do them, but yeah, I can see, like, you know, the dexterity, the flexibility, some of the strength they have in some of the positions. I could see why they would pick up grappling like that, you know.
Yeah, Eddie said they were showing a few new things that they would come up with. Because, you're always coming up with new dance moves, right?
Right.
Now, I've heard jiu-jitsu compared a lot of times to playing chess.
Yeah, I that's probably the fairest thing, you know, because there's a counter to every counter to every counter. You know, every move you do, there's a counter to it. And then there's a counter to that counter and stuff like that. And it really is. And I think that's what separates the high belts from the low belts. They only know one move after the first counter, then they're stuck, you know. As you move on, you know, you watch two high-level guys, that'll, you know, they're in the seventh and eighth move that originated with the first technique, you know. So, you know, they're countering each other. But that's what separates the I mean, that's probably the best analogy for jiu-jitsu. Mentally, you know, I mean, it's very physical, but that's probably the best one.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I'll give my first jiu-jitsu experience, all right? Now, this does not help my ego at all, Paul. All right. But I believe, you know, my book and everything I talk about is about putting yourself in uncomfortable situations for growth, right? And pushing yourself. Right. So Julian was training my daughter. She's a volleyball player. And she was done that day. And I hadn't seen Julian in years. And Julian's like, hey, man, you know, you want to roll? And I did some stand-up fighting, but I'd never grappled a day in my life.
Right.
And you know what's going to happen. And so,
see you every day, yeah.
You know, and Julian's like, why don't you want to roll? And I know what's going to happen, you know. And I said, yeah, hell yeah, I want to get my ass dropped by a black belt.
Right.
Or a brown belt at the time, I think he was. I can't remember. He's probably black then. But anyway, he lays down. He goes, you know what? Just get up, Adam. I don't want you to do anything else. Just get up, and I'll give you a minute to get up. And I said, all right. So I laid on my back. He got on top of the position. I thought, you know what? I'm bigger than Julian. I'm going to just bench press his ass off me.
Right.
You know what I mean? No big deal. 375. Yeah, what's he, a buck 80? Yeah, I got him. Yeah, dude, no. I got as far as to one knee with 2 seconds left, but had I had stood up, he had the hooks in. I was done. If I had stood up, I'd have passed right back out.
Right, right.
And I had never felt more humbled in my life. And that moment of being uncomfortable, when you really realize the technique and the method,
right,
destroyed power and strength all day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think that's why, you know, jiu-jitsu is the best martial art, I think. You know, I'm not saying that because I do it. You know, I've obviously fought and done MMA and I train Muay Thai. And I love striking as much as I love jiu-jitsu. You know, I've been doing it equal lengths, you know, because there's no rank in Muay Thai. People are like, I just get noticed for jiu-jitsu, but I've been training Muay Thai as long as I've been doing jiu-jitsu. So, but I think jiu-jitsu is the best martial art, you know.
Isn't that kind of what the MMA, the mixed martial arts, and the UFC was almost en route to do, was kind of say, all right, what is the best martial art?
Yeah, that's what historically it was. It was a, you know, Taekwondo versus a wrestler, you know, a Sambo guy versus a jiu-jitsu guy. And that's, you know, and that's how it originated, you know. And I think if the rules were the sport was the same today as it was 20 years ago, that's all people would do is jiu-jitsu. That's it. I mean,
what rules do you think keep people standing up?
Oh, obviously, just the way the rounds are scored. The shorter rounds are 5-minute rounds.
And they're still scoring on the box and 10 count, right?
Yeah, there's 10-minute rounds. I mean, there's 5-minute rounds, a 10-point mud system.
And that's boxing affiliated, right?
Yeah, it's the same scoring system. I mean, the criteria might be a little different, but you win a round, you know, like, you know, you can win a round, get your butt stomped in the third and still win the fight, you know, like, you know, so it's, yeah, it's.
I've heard a lot of people have some issues with the 10-point round system.
Yeah, a lot of controversy. I mean, people want to see it changed a little bit, you know, maybe give half points or something, but, you know, I understand it. In Japan, it was a little different. They judged it on the totality of the fight, you know, not necessarily the rounds and stuff.
How do they do that?
You know, because in say Pride, it was a 10-minute first round, then a 5-minute second round. So there's only 2 rounds. The first one was 10, but they would base it on at the end of the fight who you thought won. You know, like if you're legitimately, like, you know,
who won?
Yeah. Who'd you think won over the entire of the fight? So they didn't really score rounds and stuff like that. So
good, because 10 strikes may not equal the same as 2 really good strikes.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, as recently as some of the fights recently with Robbie Lawler and Carlos Condit. You know, I mean, Condit outstruck him by 100 punches, but, you know, Lawler hits a lot harder. So, I mean, there's some subjectivity in there, you know. And
what do you think?
Me personally, I like guys who are more aggressive and
the Lawlers.
I like not everyone's one guy's significant strike is a lot harder. So, and I'm not saying it because Robbie's American Top Team, but I had Robbie, you know, like I was scoring it round per round, you know, and, you know, so I thought it was a close fight. If either guy would have won, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, it was definitely a good fight.
Yeah. Either guy could have won stuff. I understand on paper why it looks like that way sometimes. So, but that's just part of it, you know. And the judges are going to, you know, they're going to use their own bias in how they see things. You know, people are like, well, if fighters were refs, it would be different. I'm like, no, it wouldn't. Because I'm sitting at the table with 5 fighters, and we all see that differently depending on our own bias. You know, like, you know, if you're a striker that's more aggressive and comes forward, you're going to like Robbie's. You know, if you're a more technical guy, you know, so it's not necessarily the case, you know. Like, if you're a wrestler and someone gets takedowns, you're going to be like, you'll score higher. You know, like if that was your, like you'd like to say it's not, but there's always going to have your own personal bias, how you see things, you know. You know, one guy can watch a fight and say this guy's stalling a little bit. The other guy can say, no, it's this guy, you know. So,
and you're right. I mean, it becomes perception. Could we just do a fight with no in rounds?
Yeah, well, that's the original. That's how it started. That's why there was none of that. There was no time limit. You got in. There was no rounds. Yeah, one guy was going to quit. And that's, you know, and that's what I meant by.
Seems like a fight to me.
Yeah. That's historically what it was. You know, so it's moved away from a fight and moved into a sport. But if it was still a fight with two guys in a cage, everyone would be training jiu-jitsu. That's, you know, because you would just have to know how to defend yourself until the other guy, you know, like it was. So it would be a little different than it is today, you know.
Yeah.
So guys would still train striking, but ultimately jiu-jitsu would be the most important. You know, if you could pull guard and wait, you know, I remember watching fights 55 minutes long back in the day, you know, like, you know.
I mean, that's a fight to me, man.
Yeah, you know.
I don't remember fighting out on some dirt road after school and, you know, a couple shots after a few times, and they're like, all right. Now, who do you think won? Right, I mean, you just swung until your shit was done.
Yeah, and usually fights like that, too, is usually whoever was winning at the end was, you know, was declared the victor. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, if you were beating them up at the very end and someone pulled you off, you won, you know. So,
Seems like UFC even. We talked earlier about instructors having to walk the fine line between entertainment and training and giving out black belts.
Right.
It seems like the sport has to also walk this fine line between the rules it sets to keep the paying customers versus keeping fighting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what I mean by the sport has changed so much since it started, you know, even since when I started fighting and over the years, you know. But so when I'm training guys now, it's totally different than when we were fighting per se, you know, like it's just because of the sport, you know, because of the rules of it, you know, there's certain things now, that you have to do, you know. And like when you're, for example, like I said, if you get taken down, you're going to lose the round. Whether the guy's done anything, you know, whether he's punched you and you may even have more submission attempts, you're probably going to lose the round, you know. So and if neither guy's doing something, they're going to stand you right back up. So if you take a guy and don't do something right away, I mean, they're going to stand you right back up just for that entertainment value, you know. Like, and so it's kind of taken away from a fight for sure, but it's made it more of a sport, you know. So it's not really a fight anymore. It's more, you know.
I love that separation. I love that difference. It's not a fight. It's a sport.
Yeah. And I can say that, you know. I mean, it's the closest thing to a fight, but it's not a fight. It's a sport, you know. Like it's, you know, it's not, you know, like no one's gonna stand me up or no one, you know, like it, you know. So I actually like if they would take away some of the rules. You know, I think they should. You know, even if it hurts the. You know,
the money,
entertainment a little bit.
Let's be honest, right? It's the money.
Yeah, it's definitely the money. They need more, you know, like, you know, it's getting people are getting more knowledgeable of the sport. So like when I'm out watching the fights, I don't really go out and watch them too much anymore, but when I'm out watching them, people understand what's going on now. 10 years ago, people would just be like, boo, as soon as two guys are on the ground, they'd be yelling, hit them with your purse and shit like that, you know, like, I mean, they don't understand what's going on, but so.
How fucking Roman were we?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're in this, dude, their actual technique going down in front of you, but we're like, stand him up and rip his face off.
Yeah, that's it. So I don't see that as much, but there still is that, you know, if they're on the ground too long and nothing's really happening, they'll turn to each other. They're not maybe yelling at the TV anymore. But they're talking to each other and not watching, you know, they're not like really.
That's true.
You know, they're enjoying their beer and having a wing, you know, while, you know, and then when they stand back up, then they start paying
attention.
All right,
here we go, right?
So it's not as bad, but yeah, it's definitely, you know, I'd still rather see them take that away, you know.
If you could change one rule off the bat,
I would allow them to kick or knee a guy in the head on the ground.
Okay.
I think that should be, that's, you know, like.
Yeah?
You know, I think that would be the first, you know.
Why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know. It's perception. I think athletic commissions banned it because it looked like there was a guy back in like 2000 who, you know, he was on all fours in turtle and the guy basically soccer kicked him in the head. And it looks bad. I mean, shit, yeah, really, dude, looks bad. But that's the fighting part I'm talking about. You know, like, that's what I'm telling guys, you know. But that would be the biggest rule. Like, you can have a guy wobble and have him pinned against the cage, take a step back and knee him in the head. unconscious or kick him in the skull unconscious. But if he's on the ground and I have him in a front headlock, I'm not allowed to knee him, even though, you know, like, even though the latter, the former is way more dangerous, you know? So,
right.
So it's really just perception, you know? And that's what I mean by, that would be the first rule. Like, fights would be different. It'd be more exciting too, you know? But it would be more of a fight now, you know? Like,
yeah, man.
You know, like,
so. Yeah, I like that first rule to be gone, man. I mean, if I'm on the ground kneeing, that's funny that it is all perception. You're right. I can hit you with something standing up.
Yeah, you could be, you know, just in the fetal position on the cage, and I can kick you in the head as hard as I want, you know. But the second, like I said, you're on the ground, I can't kick you no more, you know, into the head, you know. So it's like, you know,
what's the difference?
Yeah, it's just, you know,
it's just how it looks.
It's just, it really is. It's, yeah, it's perception, you know. So, and that's, you know, in Japan they still allow it, you know. So some of the fights I fought in over there, it's, you know, and that's what I meant by, like, it's not a fight anymore. Like in when we're training now, you know, like, and I got to make this differential between some of my students too, you know. I'm like, there's stuff we'll do in a sport fight that we won't do that don't do this shit in a real fight, you know, because there's no ref and there's no rules, you know.
But this is how you save your life.
And sometimes you forget a little bit, you know, because you train so much for sport fights and you train so much for, you know, guys will turn over. You see them turn up all the time, you know. And back in the old day, they would drop your elbow in the back of your neck and your spine and stuff. And, like, it's illegal now, you know. So, but that's, you know, that's why I said, you know, I wish they would take some of the rules away. To make it more of a fight again, you know, that's, you know.
Yeah, so. It's definitely, I'm going to probably use that separation for a long time, sport and a fight, you know. Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's the sport value to keep it entertaining. Are there any places other than Japan, I guess, where they still fight?
Maybe down in Brazil. I mean, they may still have, you know, because that's where it originated. You know, they, like, not it originated, but that's, I mean, they still may have some no rules fights where you can still elbow and headbutt and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, no gloves, no time limits, you know, they may still have them there, but at, you know, on a larger level, I'm not aware of it. You know, Japan has less rules. Like the fights in Asia still let you kick to the head on the ground. And
you brought up gloves. That's the other thing people talk a lot about. Would you change the gloves at all? Are there any issues with gloves that people are using or should use? Would you go bare knuckle instead?
I think the gloves actually, it probably protects your hands more than it helps the guy's face. But, yeah, I mean, I don't really have a big problem with the glove because either way, you know, like, you probably get a little, like, guys wouldn't punch as hard. If they didn't have gloves on, guys wouldn't punch, you know, but it's a little bit more real, obviously, you know, like, 10 years ago, you saw more elbows and palm strikes. 20 years ago, when the UFC first started, you know, guys either didn't. You saw a lot more broken hands too because they didn't have gloves in their hands, you know. So.
Because I've heard the gloves help sometimes when you're gripping and you can grab your wrist or you can grab the glove itself, right, when you're doing, I mean, certain moves.
Yeah, it's probably pros and cons to the grip because it's definitely easier to choke people without your gloves. That's the other thing too, is when you see guys on the back, they're like, can't get the choke in because
they're trying
to slide a glove through there. And it's just like, you know, but with just your hand, you know. So, I mean, there's pros and cons to the grips, but it definitely makes you able to punch harder. As soon as, you know, especially like pros that have been training a long time, their hands are already so, like,
beat up. My knuckles are all missing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm that's no bro. Their knuckles are all dented in.
This is a fight, man. Come on. I'm no bro. How many fights have you taken on, man? What's your record right now? What are you standing at?
By record on Sure Dog is 12-8.
Mm-hmm.
But I started fighting before a lot of those.
Well,
even.
You've been fighting in front yards, brother, since you were...
Well, not even necessarily that, but that, when we first started fighting, there wasn't no fight finders and stuff like that. So, like,
when did they start really tracking all this stuff?
Probably, like, around, you know, 98, 2000, they started tracking some of the stuff, some of the fights. You know, obviously, the bigger ones still got tracked, but it wasn't... The evolution here, at least in Florida, and probably across the country, was that you had these MMA fights, and they were way... Some of the hardest fights I ever did was before sanctioning, because that's when you could kick to the face on the ground. Well, you got to tell me one, man. Yeah, I've had fights that where we could headbutt.
You got to tell me about these fights. We ain't got nowhere to be, man. I'm interested now.
So, I mean, there used to be some of these, you know. But, you know, they didn't necessarily go on Fight Finder. You didn't care back then. It wasn't important back then. When we first started fighting, you weren't, like, I don't necessarily think we wanted to do it to make money or get into the UFC. We did it because we liked it, you know. Like, back then, the UFC didn't have weight limits, and if you're walking around at 165, you're like, you know, yeah, you're probably not going to get a shot. Back then, they only had, you know.
They were putting beasts in there.
Yeah, well, and it was a little different back then, because they only had, when it first started, a couple shows a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when I fought in the UFC in 2000, I mean, they had five shows a year. they only had 8 fights on the card, so there was 40 fights a year total in the UFC. Like, you know, and if you got one of them, you were happy. You know, like nowadays there might be 40 fights a month. Now it's just like there's one every weekend now. You know,
which is it's good for the sport.
Yeah. So it's you know, there's definitely a lot more of it and stuff like that. So, but they started tracking it right around then.
So they missed 3, 4, 5 years of you fighting.
Yeah,
period.
Even now, like there's still some fights out there that don't get sanctioned. But it's definitely a lot easier to get.
How many fights you say you've been in overall, man?
Oh, at least, 30, 35 of them at least. Like, just, I mean, with that were like, all right, you weighed in.
You did something?
Yeah. Well, they weren't like in the, they were in a ring or a cage.
You weren't doing those moves that you teach?
Yeah. When I remember back in like 98, promoters would call you and stuff. They're like, you want to fight this weekend? And you're like, yeah, I'm training hard. I might as well,
What kind of pay was it like that then?
I think you got a beer tab, maybe, or something. You got a medal or something. Like, that's what I think, these were pro fights that you didn't get paid for, And then,
Jesus. So, how as a promoter do you sleep at night and be like, hey, do you want to risk your life so I can give you a $100 bar tab?
Yeah, or something like it was, it was something like that. So
guys were warriors back then.
When you did get paid, it was you got a couple $100. It wasn't like, but what you would do is you wouldn't know who you're fighting. You would show up. They would see who shows up. They would weigh you in. If you were like anyone over 200 pounds would go to that side. Anyone under 200 pounds would go to this side. They would just be like, all right, you guys are gonna fight. And
it's like fucking kickball.
You'd go to your locker room and you start warming up,
Tell me about one of those fights for you, man. Tell me one of those head kicking knockdown. The first one that comes to your mind.
Yeah. Oh, well, the one I remember the most was, and it's one of these ones that aren't sanctioned. It was an old WEF event here, and that show went on to do big things later on. Had some of the biggest fights around the early 2000s, but when they first started, they were doing it like. It was at the Palladium. It's a club over. Yeah, it was at the Palladium. It was on a Saturday afternoon, like at 2:00. That's what I'm talking about. They were just.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they would.
They closed the Palladium after a few shootouts in the parking lot.
That's probably what.
The Palladium has now turned to what used to be Club Destiny, which is now Club something else.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I definitely know the area.
So I remember, it was one of those things. You get there, you weigh in, you're fighting this, and this guy was probably 25 pounds heavier. And it was 3 10-minute rounds.
No weight limit.
It was as long as you were under, as long as you were both under 200 pounds. So it was one of those things where we got stuck together.
Okay.
And I just remember, it's a lot heavier than me. And it was like different. It was like, there was no judges. So if it went all 30 minutes, it was just a draw. So even at the end, you didn't fucking win shit. Even if you but me and this guy proceeded to just like really just beat the shit out of each other after like.
Who's this guy?
He just disappeared. Like he was, I never met him. I never saw him after that. I don't know if he ever fought after that again.
Damn.
He was a Brazilian guy, a little bit bigger, but I just remember that, I couldn't walk for like a week after that. Like it was so bad. And it was like that was before it was sanctioning. So there was no doctors there. You didn't have any, stuff like that. And, but I remember him being in my guard. And it was the first time someone that had ever like headbutted me. He grabbed the back of my head and just put his forehead and I remember my nose going like crooked.
Oop.
And it was just like bleeding and just like, and then 15 minutes later we're both on Achilles locks and we're just kicking each other in the face, like just trying to make one of us just like, well, we were both so dead. I mean, we're just like trying to get the other guy to quit, like just please just stop, and then the last 10-minute round we probably didn't do anything. I don't even know if we were just like laying on each other doing like just slapping each other. It was just so bad, but there was blood everywhere. And then we got up, they raised both of our hands. I'm like, what the? Yeah, it was just,
you don't even know what's happening.
It was a draw. And then
probably one, it would have been like the fight of the year had it been on film or anywhere else.
Yeah, well, for the first 12 minutes, maybe. Okay. And then we were just so like, just, yeah, like, you know. Well, maybe that would have been one of the good things if they would have done stand-ups back then, because they would have made one of us get knocked out. Yeah. One of us would have just fell and just, they would have stopped it. But they didn't stop it back then. That's like they didn't stop it unless the corner threw it out or you quit, so.
A fucking fight.
Yeah. You just had to pretty much go unconscious.
A fucking fight. Back in day, football, before they changed, the rule in football back way back before face masks, leather helmets, is the play was not over until forward progress was stopped. So that means a runner could run or whatever, catch the ball, get hit, tackled. As long as he got back up and kept trying to go forward,
right,
the play was not over. And that was football. So when forward progress was stopped, so you would have giant linemen, you know, running across a field and some guy would get knocked down and back up, knocked down and back up. And maybe his third time up, he's four guys have hit him and just wham. And right, then finally he's like, all right, I'll get in the huddle. And then they go back and huddle. And that was football to me, you know?
Right.
I'm like, Jesus, man. Yeah. And so for me, the fighting and that push like that and going all that way and testing yourself, I think there's something about reaching your limit and going beyond that I think everyone in the world needs to experience once in their life, I think.
Right. And I can legitimately say when we first started, it wasn't I mean, that's why I look at some of these younger guys today, but it wasn't about money, because there wasn't any. You weren't, like you said, like even the UFC then, like it was an 8-man tournament and you won at the end if you won it. Like only one guy got paid, really, you know. Like,
yeah.
If you didn't win, you got 1,000, you know. It wasn't like, so I mean, you're doing it because you like to train, but you also wanted to test yourself. You wanted to compete. You wanted to do something, you know, like, you know,
that primal urge to compete.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, I recommend guys do with that shit, but you know, even when, you know, we have guys come in and think about competing, like you should, you know, you should just step out one day and do it, you know, like you said. I mean, there's even amateur fight now. I mean, there's a lot of rules. You wear protective gear and stuff, but it's for a lot of people that would be stepping out of a huge, you know, like, you know, just getting in a cage and with lights on and stuff, you know, in an amateur setting, you know. So if someone brings it up to me, I don't like go up and say, hey, you should fight. But if they bring it up, I'm like, yeah, I definitely recommend it just once, you know, like just, you know, definitely, you know.
Yeah, we had this guy. I'm with you, man. And this guy, Kevin Murray, he was the last podcast that we had on. Just random old guy like us, you know, just been through some shit in life, you know, but I met him through Twitter and social media and all and started following each other. But yeah, he told a great story. He was never supposed to make it anywhere in life, really. Ended up being very successful in two businesses, gave them all away, just gave his businesses away, gave his cars away, and just walked away and started a float lab, it's called My Float, you know, isolation chamber, deprivation. Yeah. Started that, but before he did that, he goes, you know what, I've always wanted to fight. And so he just goes in, it trains 28 days and takes two fights and knocks both the dudes out.
Right.
And he's like, that was fun, I'm done.
Right. Yeah, just, I mean, like, I think there is some of that. And for us, that's what we just wanted to, you know, like, and I still see guys, like, out there, but it's definitely, you know, now everybody wants the money and the fame. And hey, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, you like it per se, you know, but when you're fighting it just for that, you know, it's a little bit of, you know, so.
I get that, man. It's kind of that change of a football player too, right? We played because we loved it. And then once I kind of got into the business part of it, a lot of the love for it, for me, fell out.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not advocating guys go out there and you know, kill themselves and kill, you know, and go to war, you know, to not get paid to make some promoter a lot of money. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm just saying, you know, like there's nothing, you know, I recommend it, guys, you know, step out of their shell once in a while and jump in there and compete a little bit, especially if you train a lot, you know, especially if, you know, so.
What would you say is probably one of the most important things a fighter needs, man, if they're walking into it, other than, you know, some obvious basics, but maybe mentally, maybe we're talking.
I say to reach a high level, to, you know, especially now, because it's a little different now in the sense that guys are starting younger. You know, as more money gets involved in it, the people get better, the athletes get better, the, you know, everybody gets better. So I think first things I look for is obviously their discipline and their commitment and stuff like that. That's the first thing, I think, because I think that's just everything in life, basically. You know, if, you know, the whole talent is overrated thing, you know, if you know, if you don't have the work ethic, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter and stuff like that. So and then secondly is like the intangible stuff, like you were saying, the mental part of it, you know, like how, I mean, you can teach guys toughness per se. You can make them a little tougher, but it, like, you know, there's some guys who are just tougher than others in a sense that, you know, they just, some guys will always shy away from a punch, you know, or not want to get hit, you know? And I think that's why it makes the sport the mentally hardest, the mentally challenging. You know, you could be in control. You can be cruising. I mean, you can be all over this guy, you know, picking him apart, you know, taking him down, controlling him. But there's still that, you know, this guy hits me, you know. That's it, you know. Like, it's not like football where just, you know, or any other things, you know. And that's I think that's why it's the most challenging mental sport. You know, it'd be like, you know, being up the bat in baseball in the World Series with, you know, bottom of the ninth and you know, two outs and a winning run on second, you know, something like that all the time, you know, because in other sports, if you make a mistake, like Tex Cobb, the boxer, he's like, if you make a mistake in tennis, I'm down 15 love, you know. If I make a mistake in boxing, I'm out. I get knocked out and stuff. So I think that's what makes it the most challenging sport, you know. So, yeah, you definitely have to find those qualities. You know, like some guys are a little bit better at those qualities. Some guys, it can be developed. I mean, I think GSP is a good example. He wasn't like the most mentally strong guy, but his work ethic and his skill set and his physical tools were up there, you know. So, you know, it just – and I think if GSP was stronger in that last category, he probably would have finished most of his guys instead of just beating the crap out of them. And that's, you know, so, but he still was the best, you know, he still was the, you know, best welterweight ever. And, you know, arguably one of the top three guys ever and stuff like that. So, why I think
it sounds like you're talking about like it. Can you see, you know, how coaches and athletes, they talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some guys like you see it. And if they have like that, one, like I said, they have to have the work ethic and the determination, the commitment first. That's probably before anything, you know. But then, if you see like that, like that's what I said, like other, you could be a really great athlete, excel in basketball, but no one's punched you in the face, so it doesn't, your athletic ability goes from here to here, you know. So, but in fighting, you have to, like I said, when someone's hitting you, you have to be mentally tough. You know, you have to be like, and some guys are just better at that. Some people are just better at that. I don't know. It's a mental quality. Maybe some kids grew up a little rougher, you know. I mean, you know, they grew up with brothers who they fought all the time and stuff like that. But even at a high level, it's weird because you figure if someone got that high, they would be, you know. But I think that's the, you know, early on, the striking, the punching, someone hitting you is a quality that will turn a lot of people off or weed them out early. And then after that is what, just the competition jitters, you know, like that's with every sport. A lot of, I mean, so I had that. I wasn't like, you know, I was a guy that was a lot better in the gym, you know, like I said, my record was 12-8, on Sure Dog, you know, but that was against all the guys that like high level guys, you know, that was my record against like, you know,
who's the best you ever fought?
What's that?
Who's the best you ever fought?
I fought Takanori Gomi in Japan when he was, you know, probably the best lightweight in the world. I fought Ishida when he was top 10 in the world.
Damn.
I fought George Masvidal, you know. I fought Dennis Hallman. Like, see, it was a little different back then, too, because, like I said, there wasn't a lot of fights in the UFC. So everyone fought. In fact, when I was going, you wanted to fight in Japan. You didn't want to fight in the UFC. I got paid better in Japan. It was a little different before 2006. After the Ultimate Fighter, now everybody wants to go to the UFC.
So 2006 changed everything.
Yeah, after the Ultimate Fighter and the first Ultimate Fighter and MMA took off here, that's when they started getting on regular TV. That's when they started doing all this stuff. The money got better, and then everybody wanted to go to the UFC. Prior to that, BJ Penn left and went to Japan after he won the title. Murilo Bustamante left. Like, you got paid better over there. So you want, the best guys were fighting over there. So you wanted to fight over there. So it was a little different, but, and they didn't hold you to, like, necessarily, like, contracts where you couldn't fight outside. So, like, I mean, of those 20 guys, I'm saying, and when I fought, I mean, I say 15 of them fought in the UFC. You know, it just, I might not fought them in the UFC. I didn't fight Dennis Hallman in the UFC, but like, I fought 20 fights. I didn't fight Masvidal in the UFC, but so yeah, but we all fought somewhere. You know, so it's a little different back then. Now, you know, because they're doing 20 UFCs a month, it seems like.
It does.
You want to go to the UFC because you will get work now, and all the best guys are migrating there, kind of. So, and, you know,
they've kind of taken it over.
Yeah. They're definitely Bellator's pulling a little bit of talent here and there, but most of the best guys, I think, are going to the UFC, you know. So,
and despite the Reebok deal and the money issues, because they kind of capped them a little bit with that deal, didn't they?
Yeah, I think if you're like an established guy or if you're a UFC guy that's been there and maybe coming down a little bit, you know, you might bolt. But if you're a young kid, you know, like, you definitely, you know, you definitely go to the UFC just because the potential to make money, the potential to make is so much greater. You know, you have to win. I mean, that's just, you know, but so.
What I'm going to try to dive into the psyche a little bit of the great Paul Rodriguez, man. What story do you think in your past life may be most influential in defining the fighter, Paul Rodriguez? Other than that long, drawn-out shit-kicking, ass-kicking for no money where you two are beating the shit out of each other for, I guess, fun. Right. That was a hell of a story.
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I don't know.
I tend not to ask a lot of dry questions. You know, I'm trying, because for me, man, I love to crawl into the person's head. You know, I mean, counselor background, that's what I do. You know, so being a mental trainer is what I do in myself. So when I sit in front of you, for me, I want to extract all of the mental nutrients from Paul Rodriguez that I can.
Right.
You know, so when I ask, you know, questions like that, it's because, I mean, I honestly respect what you do, the life that you lead, how you live, how you speak. And the guys that have been telling me who you are great men too. You know, so for me to sit in front of you and not want to get into the psyche mind, to the coach and to the fighter and to the philosophy of Paul Rodriguez, I think would be something that I would regret and miss if I don't do that. You know, so it, like I said, it's a pleasure to have you in front of me. So to, you know, dive in your psyche, man, what, you know, maybe a better way to ask that question is what drives you or drove you through those early years through nothing? Through no money, through no fame, what drove the fighter Paul Rodriguez to keep pushing?
I don't know. I'd say early on, you know, like I wanted to compete. Like I started training. So, you know, I thought, like I said, when you especially back then when you first saw what Hoist was doing, you know, I didn't even know what was going on half the time when he was getting hit, but then he submitted the guy. You know, So I wanted to compete, and then when I really started getting into it, because like I said, I played sports growing up and stuff, but I think fighting is the purest sense of sport there is, you know, because it really is just you versus, you know, your opponent. You have no teammates, you have none of this and that, you know, it's the purest sense of sport. You're standing in front of people in a cage, half naked, and it's just you versus him, you know, and there was something about that, you know, like early on that you know, I enjoyed, you know, and then, and it was fun in a sense that, you know, because it was the purest sense of sport, I think that I enjoyed, that I wanted to go back and train harder to get better at doing that, you know, and I think that's, you know, especially back then for a lot of guys, that's what it was. And then once, it got bigger. Once the money came in, I can actually make a living off doing this. That's when the jitters come in. When you were doing it early on just for love, you know, like you didn't care. Like we were both doing it, you know, like win or lose, but you wanted to win, obviously, and stuff like that. But once you're making a career out of it, you're making money, like this is how you're going to sustain yourself, that's when I think guys start to get that jitter, you know, I have to win this if I want to get to here, or if I lose this fight, I'm out of the UFC. And then that's when the nerves set in. That's when it becomes, you start to lose the passion for it a little bit, because you're not doing it for love anymore. You're not doing it because you wanted to compete, you know. So early on, that's what, for me, you know, obviously I was always competitive. You know, I grew up with brothers and sisters. You know, like we used to fight all the time. I mean, they, you know.
Well, it sounds to me the purity of passion, you know, of that being the primal human that Paul was at the time. Sorry for the third person reference,
right.
But to live in that primal moment and stay in it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's you know, looking back on it for sure. But I know that's what it was, because like I said, there was no money. You know, there was no, you know, I never added. You know, and it's not just me, but a lot of guys back then. Until, like I said, then until you started, you know, getting money and trying to think about making a career out of it. But a lot of guys back then,
you guys are a special breed, man.
They didn't ask you. They asked if you wanted to fight, and you said yes or no. They, you know, you didn't, you know, nowadays, you know, you ask a guy, do you want to fight? And you're like, okay,
who is it? What's his record? How much is the weight? What's the money? And I get that, you know, because now you have a chance to make, you know, I mean, Conor McGregor was on welfare 2 years ago, and now he's a millionaire, you know? So I understand that, you know. Now, like I said, if I'm grooming a kid, I'm you know, if someone asks me about my fighter, I'm asking those questions now, you know? So it's a little, you know, that's what I'm talking about, the sport kind of taking it over, you know? But I think if everyone looked back onto that initial love for it, you know, like, you know, and even the young guys today that may have only a couple of fights, initially they probably did it for love too, the first couple, because they didn't, you know, maybe, yeah, I want to be in the UFC someday, but that's not, you know, that doesn't set in until you get a few fights underneath your belt and stuff. It's a dream, it's a goal, but it's not like, you know, you don't have those jitters yet in a sense, because you're just starting out, you know. People say it gets easier as you go on, as you get more experience, and that's true a little bit, but it actually, if you're successful early on, it gets harder. The nerves get worse because you have more riding on it, you know. Your first fights usually your easiest, you know. You don't know what's going to happen. You're doing it because you want to do it, you know. You want to try it out, you know. Like, you know, stuff like that. So, but for me early on, that's definitely what it was, you know. Because, like, yeah, I'd love to fight this weekend. I'll be there, you know.
I'll go right now is what you're saying.
We'll do it, yeah. It's, you know, like, you know, so even – I remember I fought – it used to be a club over here off Alafay. It was the only one when I was in UCF that was it was Headlights. Remember the old Headlights club?
Yes, I do.
So they'd have fights there. I remember fighting there like 3 or 4 times, and you know, they had them on Saturdays, at, you know, in the afternoon before the club opened up at night, and you know, they put a ring up, and you'd get there, and you know,
do your thing,
yeah, stuff like that. And it wasn't, like I said,
you did it for the love,
yeah.
Man.
You got to go. You got to go drink it out. You did it because you wanted to compete, and you want, you know, in a one of the the toughest sport there is, you know. So it was, you know, and I would be lying if I said there wasn't part of that, you know, that I still want to do. I still want to, you know, like, you know, and like I said, if I go back and fight now, and I'm talking about it now. I'm talking to my girl about it, you know, and but it's not to make money or make a run to the UFC, you know. It's just it's to compete, and it's, you know,
That's what you need
to this. Yeah, I you know,
maybe that's it. Right. Maybe last time was because it was for the money and for the support.
There's so many guys, you know, they get nervous, like, especially, you know,
but you should, man.
You know, oh yeah, no, I'm feeling good. I'm training hard. I'm you know,
you're gonna
I'm,
fight
I'm,
again.
I'm going with these guys. Yeah, I you know,
you're gonna fight
do something this year. You know,
you're gonna fight again.
Yeah, yeah, I'm gonna fight again.
Okay, so. There we go. I got you to all say
right.
It.
So yeah, there it is.
Because look, short term pain and long term pain, brother. Long term pain, you got to live with what happens if I don't.
Right.
Short term pain means you lose. So fucking what?
Yeah, yeah. That's, you know, that, yeah. I'm doing it for love now. You know, and that's, you know, and that's, you know, I train enough, and even the guys in the gym say, you know, because they see me, you know. Like, yes, you can go in and spar hard with these young guys, you know. Like, you know, when I go with Julian, I mean, just, you know, I can't keep him off me now, you know. Like, you know, his skill set has caught mine, and, you know, he's obviously a little bigger and he's a better athlete. So,
has the teacher caught to the master?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I can't keep him off me now, per se, you know. Like,
you're a humble man.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff like that. Well, it's, you know, it was a gradual thing, but, you know, his skill set caught up to his athletic ability, and, you know, and he's, you know, stuff like that. So, but when I go with him, I mean, I go hard with him, and we go, you know, and I think he could, you know, he just needs to get in there. He needs a shot, you know, but, you know.
Am I hearing Coach Paul Rodriguez come out now?
A little bit, but you know, but just, you know, but I'm sparring with guys like this, and I know, you know, I know their skill set and stuff, and I want to do it, you know, so.
You're gonna do it.
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. You're gonna. You know, you're sitting in front of a mental trainer, brother.
Yeah.
You see what I'm doing, right? You'd whoop my ass on a mat any day of the week, man. Any day of the fucking year. We sit here and start talking mental stuff, brother. I'm excited that you're gonna do this, man.
Yeah. So I. Yeah. To get back to your original question, I think that's.
back pedal.
That's probably why, and that's probably if I do it. You know, when I do it now, that'll be why. It won't be because
when
know,
I do it,
it won't be to make yeah.
And that is going to be a Paul Rodriguez that somebody's going to get fucked up, because Paul's just going to come in just doing it because he loves to do it.
I'm going
to
be loose and have fun. You know, I'm not. You know.
Somebody's going to get hurt. So if you're out there and you're listening to this podcast and you don't know it, very soon this year you're going to get choked out. It'll be okay. You'll be all right tomorrow. But Paul's just doing it for the love. So more than likely you're going to get your ass tore up. But you know, I'll move on to my last couple of questions, man. As we wrap up. You started to go into Coach Paul Rodriguez, right? Coach Rodriguez. And I loved hearing that part about you. I could hear the love for the Roxy. I told you she'd be a part of the podcast. No, you have a pug too, right?
Yeah, I got a Rocky. Yep, had him almost 15 years now. Yeah.
Rocky. So Rocky and Roxy. you got a male. I got a female. Yeah, we should get them together. That's awesome. So see all of you out there that see my fucking manly ass walking my pug that want to laugh at me. Well, you know what? Mr. Paul Rodriguez has a pug too, and I dare you. You know what I mean? He's walking his pug too, man.
They're the best dogs out there. Best, you know.
Wow. Shout out to the pugs. But, you know, from the coaching aspect, you know, what's your coaching philosophy, coaching fighters?
And I'm starting to get a beat on this, you know. Historically, I was kind of developing it, you know, but I'm getting a little bit better a beat on this, you know. Obviously, like I said, what I was saying earlier is, you know, you need to train hard. But, what you know, obviously, I think you need to train a lot smarter now than we did, you know. So that's the biggest thing. I'm trying to get guys into more deliberate practice and not necessarily, you know.
What's that mean? What's deliberate practice?
Deliberate practice means, like, you know, working on specific things. So right now, what a lot of guys do, especially like early fighters. Now, this is after they're pro, but they come in and they just train too much. They spar too much. They don't necessarily drill the stuff. They don't drill. They don't practice enough the right things. You know, everybody. It's because you know why? Because sparring's fun, especially if you want to fight. Because grappling's fun. You know, rolling live is fun. You know, doing wrestling's fun. You know, it's competitive. You get your juices going. It's fun. You know, drilling is just not as fun. You know, going. You know, just. You know, conditioning fucking not as fun, you know, like, you know, yeah. Yeah, it's just, so, when I mean deliberate practice, I think it's Jeff Calvin, talent is overrated. He went over this piece in there about Jerry Rice, who is, the best wide receiver of all time, arguably the best football of all time. And it goes over his work ethic, but it goes over actually how much time he actually spent playing football, like scrimmaging, you know. What Jerry Rice did was he went out and ran routes every day. He went out and he did all the boring stuff that you can't get people to do, you know. But he estimated that Jerry Rice played football 2% of the time, and the other 98% he was either, you know, running routes, he was conditioning, he was watching mental, you know, he was working on his mental game, he was watching film, he was doing all this stuff. But he was putting his 5 hours in a day, but it was directed at shoring up holes in this week, you know, shoring up the holes in his game and stuff like that, you know. Because, I mean, the guy was phenomenal. He ran a 4.7 40 out of college, you know. Like, that's, you know.
Yeah,
like,
4.43.
Yeah, you know, like
4.3.
You know, so it's crazy now, like, how hard his work ethic was. So, but, so I think a lot of guys are, me personally, I'm trying to get guys out of sparring as much. You know, like, you know, and this is kind of throughout the sport. Everyone's kind of getting on this now. Most pros, they're not sparring live as much. You know, they're taking care of their bodies. You know, they're training a little bit smarter and stuff like that. So, but you got to be a beast. You got to fucking work hard. You got to train every day. You got to put your hours in, but you got to do the right things, you know. And that's where it gets, you know, and I think the right things is what confuses a lot of young guys, you know. And that's why they need a coach. And it's a little different when I was coming up, because there was no MMA coaches back then. There was a boxing coach and a jiu-jitsu coach, and they couldn't agree on shit. You know, like, they couldn't agree on what's, you know, they would try to get to their individual skills, but they didn't.
Boxers going stand up, guys going grapple. Get them to?
Yeah, or a boxing coach will try to tell you to do something, but you as a fighter will know, I can't really do that in an MMA fight because he'll kick me. But so all of a sudden now you're coaching yourself. So it's you know, which nowadays there's guys that understand, you know, like, so, you know, the first generation guys are starting to come MMA coaches, you know, Dwayne Ludwig and these guys who did everything and fought and stuff, or kind of understand it now. So, but a lot of guys just don't know what the right things are, you know, and they still have this macho, I got to go in and spar 10 rounds a night, you know, and stuff like that. So that's out there. It's still
like
out there.
This Rocky Balboa mentality, almost.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to wake up and run 5 miles, and I'm going to go to the gym and spar 10 rounds, and I'm going to come back at night and grapple 5 rounds. And nobody's doing that. The best guys the guys with the training philosophies of the major sports are seeking an MMA now that the money's there. You know, people are getting smarter and stuff like that. You know, NFL players don't go out and fucking scrimmage every day, and they don't hit each other in the knees with baseball bats. Are tough enough, you know? Like, I mean, they don't. I mean, they,
no, yeah, you're right.
They, you know, they run plays, they practice, you know, they drill, you know, and stuff like that. But they don't. So that's
because what you can only technically, right? They're trying to say you can only take so many of those one shots to the dome.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah. You kind of see that, you know, guys. You know, the chins are leaving. So. That's. I mean, guys are getting a lot more smarter now. Their training and taking care of themselves, you know. And so MMA is not as, like, boxing obviously a lot harder on the head, you know, because it's only, you know, you can only hit the body in the head, you know. Even Muay Thai is a little lighter because you can kick in the legs, so the pain's distributed a little bit equally. MMA is obviously even better, but it's the 10 years of sparring five times a week that guys used to do is what catches up with them later on. So, you know, guys are much more smarter now, you know. I heard Khan talking about retiring just because of, you know, recently because of just he wants to take care of his brain, you know. Like, a lot of guys are, you know, it's out there and stuff like that. So that would be the change in my philosophy. Did I always have that? Hell no. I was like, we're gonna put you out there. 10 guys are gonna rotate on you every minute. We're gonna beat the shit out of you. You know, if you survive, you're probably not a better fighter, but you'll be tougher. That's what we did. That's what everyone did back then. You know?
That's some bull in the ring shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's you know, it's that machismo thing back in the day. So you know, that's definitely gone from, like, you know, I promise you, John Jones ain't training like that. I promise you, all the best guys in the world ain't training like that. So you just see it, like, with the early fighters that think it's like that. You know, they think that it's like that, but it's really not like that. You know.
It's so, becoming this practitioner's game.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, they're conditioning hard, and they're tough dudes. When they spar hard. I mean, there's a little bit of that. You know, not all the time. I mean, obviously not all the time. You know,
there's those guys you just don't spar with, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's still those guys out there. You know, and different guys prepare differently. Some guys need to do that psychologically, so you got to hope you have some tougher sparring partners for them. You know, but it's not necessarily the best. But at the point with where they're at in their careers and how long they've been doing that, you know, like, if you were to change something up and say, okay, we're gonna do technical sparring and we're only gonna do situational sparring, it would kind of mess them up maybe. But for most guys, I mean for the younger guys, they just need to train a little bit smarter, and that's what we're trying to do now, you know, is monitor rounds and stuff like that. And It's a pain. It goes back to our original conversation, but getting people to drill is the hardest thing in the world. You know, sparring is fun. It's easy. You know, getting people to drill, you know, like, it's the hardest thing in the world to do. You know, it's like getting a NBA guy to go out and shoot free throws for practice. You know, I know they do it. That's why they're there.
That's right.
I've read Kobe Bryant get up 4 a.m. and go shoot, you know, 100, you know, like, I know, you know, like, you know.
But how do you sell that, right?
They'd probably rather scrimmage. You know, they'd probably rather play each other and let's play a pickup game. Let's run the court. But that's not what they're doing. You know, it's.
You can't teach the body that way. I think you know, a lot of the ways.
Right.
You know, so. How would you say that your fighting, your coaching philosophy, or just the world of fighting, everything that you've taken into your life, or how has that played into your real life? How do you either manage the two, or obviously you do it for a living, so you've merged the two, but are there things that you've learned basically from the fighting and growing up that you apply in your life outside of the ring or even outside of the gym?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, it might be vice versa too. It might have been like, you know, studying business might have actually been like, yeah, they, you know, these guys were, you know, the 20-80 rule and stuff like that. And
You just came out of the 20-80 Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week, if something.
Stuff like that, and that Pareto's principle. So, I mean, some of that stuff, you know, but I know, like, you know, trying to get better at business, and you read guys with, you know, they're working on the right things, you know, they're doing the right, you know, they're not, like, I know guys that train 20 hours a week, but they're not doing the right things. It's the same, like, you know, obviously in business, you know, if you're not doing, you could be busy, but not productive, you know, and that's what I think the problem with fighters is, you know, and that's the principle I think I've meshed in my life. I'm trying to be more productive, not necessarily busy, you know, like I've been, so that's basically what the, you know, the biggest thing that I've taken over is. I know guys that train in a fight that are busy, man. You know, this, and I'm like, I'm looking through it. I'm like, you're not really productive. You're not, you know, more isn't better. You know, better is better. So it's, you know,
There's some of them coaching philosophies coming out, man.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, just, you know, I know, like you said, you know, God, more isn't better, you know. I got some, I did 13 rounds yesterday. I'm like, are you better, you know? Like, it's just, better is better, you know? Like,
well, when you say busy is, well, what do we hear from, like, friends that we want to talk to or people, right? Well, sorry, I'm just real busy today. This guy, it's a interview I recommend everybody listen to on I want to say Seavers, on Tim Ferriss's podcast. But he talks about the idea of people being busy. What he really hears is, you're not in control.
Yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, you know, like, yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. You're not, you know, you're not, you're letting circumstances dictate you, and you're not, you know, you're not putting your priorities in line and stuff like that. So that's absolutely, and I was guilty of that for a long time. And I'm probably still guilty of it a little bit now, you know. But definitely not to the T that I used to be. You know, I'd always be, I'm too busy for this, I'm too busy for that. But I wasn't really busy. I was just putting my time in the wrong things and stuff like that.
And the 80-20 rule you're referencing for the listeners, what he's saying is, if you're putting 80% of your time into something and it's only giving you 20% return, then it's much better for you to cut the 20% return and free up 80% of your time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. And like I said, and when I first read the principle, it was a little hard to enact, but I'm definitely, and it's out there, you know. It's, you know, if you look at my diet, it's 80% of the time, like, I, you know, I eat 20, you know, 20% of the time I eat 80% of the same things, and, you know, it's just everything. Like, you know, I know when the concept was introduced to me, it's, you know, it's like, these, this is out there in your life somewhere, you know, and you have to find how to, you know, the right things to, you know, because it's going to be there, but you have to find what's yielding you the best results, you know, and then go from there. So
how does, I can imagine, like, a fighter like you coming back to fight this year, the hours that you put in weekly, and mind you, not everybody that's training to fight also isn't in the fighting business. You know, right. They have jobs and families.
Exactly.
How do you help fighters balance that, other than calling me as a mental trainer and helping me come in and I help the fighters balance their lives outside of the ring? I'm throwing myself out there, you like that. But I'm from
that's
your
huge part, yeah.
That's kind of what I want to get into. Yeah, but how but seriously, how do you do that and try to keep that in line, balancing family, business, and what? How many hours a week is going back to fighting require?
Right. I mean, I would say, like, you know, the lucky thing for me is, for what I do, it's not, you know, like, I'm in the gym and I'm already sparring and I'm already,
you live there anyway.
Yeah, I'm already lifting and I'm already sparring, and, you know, I just, you know, just got to add some more specific conditioning. But for a lot of guys, it's tricky, you know, because the sport is almost to the point where if you're doing other things, you probably aren't going to make it, you know, because the guys you're fighting aren't doing those things. They're, you know, they're either being sponsored or, you know, like, it's tricky when you first start. Yeah, everyone's got to, you know, ideally you have some type of support staff, you know, hopefully, you know, your family's, you know, supporting you and your girl's supporting you. But if you're working 50 hours a week and you have two kids and you're training 10 hours a week and the other guy doesn't have any of that and he's training 20 hours a week, you know, it may not, your skill set may be better than his, but eventually at a high level it'll catch up with you. So it's almost getting to the point where if you're not, like, that's the first thing is commitment, you know. If you're not dedicated into it that much, you know, to get to a high level, not just to fight. To fight, you know, if you just, you know, like I said, if you want to do the best you can with what you have, you know, then it, you know, you try to, like I said, you try to yield the best results. It's okay, I get you for this many hours, and this is what we need to do, and we look at the, you know, what 20% of things are going to yield us the best results, and we don't, you know, so it really is how it's done, you know, like, with guys who are training to want to be, you know, world champs and get to the UFC, and they don't really necessarily, you know, they only work maybe 5-10 hours a week just to have money for food, you know, they're being taken care of, however, family, you know, let them, you know, supporting their dream, you know, give them some sponsorship, or maybe they have sponsors that are paying for it, but it's a little different. But
so, I mean, what you're saying is to be a fighter, you really can't be one foot in, one foot out. You really just have to do
nowadays.
It
10 years ago, everyone, guys still had jobs and stuff. Rich Franklin was a teacher when he became the UFC champ. You know, like, but nowadays, no. Nowadays, you have to be, you know, it's just what it's required. As you know, more guys are committing themselves, and so without a doubt, that's, you know, I think Conor McGregor said, you know, there's no talent. He's like, I'm obsessed. You know, I'm in. This is what I do. You know, like, you know, that's, you know. But I think it's that certain thing, you know, you have to be, you know, you don't have to be, you know, 10 hours a day training, like, you know, like crazy. But if you're doing the right thing, but you have to be, you know, all in, you know, to get to that certain level. Not to fight. To fight, you know, you can still get you, you know, like I said, that, you know, you got to do it once.
Hey, ass whippings are free. You don't have to train for any kind of ass whipping.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, lead in, we talked about, you know, having, you know, the girls support you, et cetera, but are you seeing a giant influx of females entering the sport?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, Gina started it, but Rhonda is, you know, like, I mean, she put it on the map, you know. So, and actually, if you're, and it's not knocking or anything, but the talent, class, it's new, so it's thin, so you don't need a lot of fights. If you're a female, you can get into the UFC relatively fast. So if say you had a martial art background and you've done sport karate your whole life, or you did striking, like, you know, Joanna is a kickboxing champ, or if you wrestled your whole life, you know, I mean, and if you have that mental quality where you're not worried about getting hit, you know, you could get into the UFC relatively fast, you know. And
you're saying right now is the chance for a female fighter.
Because like the talent levels is thin, you know, they need fighters, you know, you can have two fights, you know, and get into the UFC as a female, you know, because, you know, if you look okay, and I mean, you know, obviously 10 years from now, we won't be like that, but.
And mind you, he said not look okay if you're pretty, okay? So don't get him as if he said if you look okay,
Yeah, no, I meant if your skill set looks okay, you know.
Those females
like,
will
that's
get
what
you.
I meant. So, like, if, you know, so that's, it's, you know, it's a thinner weight class because it's new. That's the only reason. It's just because it's new. As it gets more established, more, you know, all these young girls training martial arts. You know, we have a young girl at our school. Just like, you know, she's been doing sport karate her whole life. She does jiu-jitsu now. And, you know, like, girls like that, if she wanted to, you know, could, you know, 10 years from now. But that'll be the norm in women's MMA is what I meant. Is like, okay, you know. And that's why I think Rhonda was so dominant. And that's why Holly Holm was dominant. And that's all the girls that have done something their whole lives are the dominant ones. You know, they're fighting chicks that have been training for 3 years. And that's. It's tough. You know?
You see the difference.
Yeah, you see the difference. It's exactly right. You know, so it's hard to close that gap with the, you know. But the problem is, it's only those three that have done something their whole lives. You know, them four, and then the other 30 have kind of all started around the same time. You know,
so I can imagine in 10 years, brother, what the MMA field's going to look like with all the training. I mean, think about these golfers. You know, you got a 9-year-old winning PGA tournaments.
Right.
You know, can you imagine a jiu-jitsu tournament 10 years from now with some kid or girl or boy?
I see it. I'm watching videos of these, you know, these kids, you know, and I'm, you know, and like, you know, and yeah, so that's what I mean. Like the champs, you know, in 20 years are going to be so much better than the guys today, you know. So.
Like, they'll be half cyborg too, bro. Yeah, they'll be half like metal. They'll be genetically modified fucking mutants.
Right.
It'd be like, this won't even be MMA anymore, man. It'd be some video game or some shit.
Yeah, so yeah, you'll definitely see that in the future, you know, because it just, you know, like I said, and more and more athletes will start coming into the sport as the pay gets better, you know, so.
You see a crossover. Well, any love out there for anybody thinking about getting into sport, maybe anybody thinking about fighting, any words of wisdom to that person sitting out there on the fence about any of that?
I guess my biggest thing is that, you know, just kind of what I've been harping on the whole time is that if you want to fight or if you want to probably achieve mastery in anything or be successful in anything is that you have to commit yourself. I mean, you have to be dedicated and put the time in. There's no way around it. I mean, it's just, you know, like I you know, the 10,000 hours of mastery thing, it might not be that much, you know, I've said this before, but it's a fucking lot. You know, you have to commit yourself a lot to achieving success. And in saying that, you know, you got to make sure you're doing the right thing. So not, you know, you can be busy and be practicing and doing all the wrong shit, but not necessarily getting better, you know, and doing the right thing. So, you got to find a place that, you know, find a coach. I'm not saying me, but make sure you have, you know.
Speaking of, where can everybody find you? What's your school? Give all the loves, all the .coms, all the Twitters.
Well, if you are looking to fight, you know, like I said, I've been around this since its inception. You can find our school at attorlando.com. We're right here in East Orlando. We got a pretty big facility. We got all the bells and whistles, cages, weights, lifts, everything that you need to become a pro. But like I said before, you know, we also have just a lot of people who like to train and stuff like that. So we'll train you. We're not going to water down our product for you, but if you want to come in and train, we'll make you, you know, a legit badass. I'll get you in shape, and someone messes with you, you'll be able to whip their ass. I promise you that. There's no, I just, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You know, yes, you'll get
you
all
know,
that
I,
stuff. But
I think every woman should learn it. Can you imagine some college boy trying to rape a Ronda Rousey?
Absolutely.
Some jiu-jitsu expert chick?
I firmly believe in it. I make my girl change. You know, like, I mean, I think it's good for. I think you should. I think you should. You know, like, you know, you don't necessarily have to be the, you know, trained to get to the level of UFC and stuff like that. But you know, you'd be surprised after about a year. You know, you would probably win 99.9% of your altercations. You know, I mean, and violently too, if you wanted to. You know, depending on how mad you were.
Yeah.
Because how you know, so
I think women should learn off the rip. I mean, my wife has a license to carry, so she's trained well both ends, but, you know, more on this end. But, you know, I for females, you know, what a lot of men don't understand and will never understand, I'll never even understand it, is what it feels like to constantly walking around knowing that the other species technically could take you out at any time.
Right.
You know, imagine what that feels like, dude, when you're just walking down the street, anywhere you're at, that other species could just be like, you know what?
Right.
I'm going to.
Yeah.
We never get to feel that.
Right. Never.
You know? Yeah, and so for females to know jiu-jitsu and even, I think, to be strapped too.
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, jiu-jitsu, I would say, would come first because that's hand-to-hand. That's in your face. But,
right.
You know, please, guys, everyone out there, if you're looking to train, if you want to train, or if you more than likely really just want to be a badass fighter and you want to get it for real, you're the man to fight.
Yeah. If you definitely want to fight, I definitely think I got the knowledge and strategies and stuff like that, and you know, and to train you and get you there and stuff like that.
And where did you say they go? AT to find you directly?
ATTOrlando.com. So you know, we're the American Top Team Academy here. We're most of the trotters train and stuff. In fact, all of them train and stuff like that and come down and stuff. So but yeah, come check us out. Come check me out.
Where are you at on Facebook, Twitter, any of those places?
Yeah, American Top Team's on there. You can check out my own page at Paul Reese. But American Top Team we're ATT Orlando on Facebook. We're on Twitter. You know,
everywhere, man.
Yeah, we're doing it. You know, we're putting out videos and information out there all the time.
Anybody fighting in your camp that we need to shout out or send people to a fight to go see or something?
We got a couple guys fighting next month in Tampa in the RFC. We got some young guys. You know, these guys we're talking about. You know,
any names?
Matt Ferriola, he's fighting in the RFC on.
He's the little shorter guy, dark hair.
Nah,
it's been years. I think I knew him like years and years ago.
And Will Sizemore, they got fights coming up, and these guys are both, you know, three fights into their career. But so it's
where's that fight at?
It's in Tampa. And they're fighting in the RFC. RFC is the longest running show in Florida right now. So they've been doing it since 2005 or 2006, and we're in there. So
shout out to RFC.
So that's a good show, and then we got some new people. Just kind of, they moved back to Orlando. I want to give a shout out to Alex Spartan. You know, he's been coming down training with me. He's fighting the UFC this Saturday. So,
shout out Alex. Yeah,
Alex will be fighting the UFC. His girl Hannah. Hannah's fighting next month in Pensacola. I think her opponent's going to fight her, so she's fighting next month in Pensacola. So, a lot of guys come and fight. We have, you know, tons of guys. Mark Geiger's fighting it. You know, a lot of guys fighting coming up. So, very busy schedule this year. We're trying to grow the team. I'm rebuilding.
You know who I heard else was fighting? I heard Paul Rodriguez was fighting this year.
And me. Look for my day return this year. So, kind of said it. I've been thinking about it a long time and, like, for no other reason but what we talked about for that love. So, I need to compete, you know.
I'll fucking be there, baby.
You know? I don't think a grappling tournament will do it, you know. So a lot of guys, when they get low, they go to grappling tournaments and still compete. And I don't think that'll do it for me. That's not enough, I think. You know,
Somebody wants to hurt somebody.
Yeah, I need to be. I need to be in a cage or something. So you need to be punching. So just win or lose, I'm gonna go out there and give my best fight. I'm gonna win. So.
Watching this thing the whole fucking time, man.
Yeah. So.
Well, any love, shout outs to family, friends, anybody you want to love too, man? Before we go, man.
Obviously, my biggest supporter, Caroline Rodriguez. That's my. We just celebrated 4 years, so we've been together.
Congrats, man!
She's my second self, my better half. So, that's without her. You know, like I said, just, you know, she makes this whole thing worthwhile. So,
That's good, brother. Yeah, you got to give love, man. Hey, behind a lot of strong men, man, you find a really strong woman.
Yeah, yeah. She, yeah. And that's what I got there. And I'm lucky and I'm blessed to have her for sure.
So. Yeah, man. I like to say that I married smarter than me, right? And just so I would know, but then I can at least say, well, who's really smarter if I knew to marry smarter than me, right?
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Well, they really just deal with our shit, don't they?
Right. Yeah, and I put tons on her, you know, and she loves me, and I'm telling you, I got the best one, you know, so.
Shout out to all the family supporters, the husbands that support the female fighters and the females supporting their male fighters. Shout out to all of you out there that are supporting your loved one.
Absolutely. Yeah. The guys I know, you know, the guys are trying to do it. You know, I know you guys go through a lot and you know, you're looking at your man, you're telling him, damn, you need to go get a job, you know, but yeah, you're thinking that, but you're supporting their dream, you know, and that's what they need. I mean, they need good, you know, like everyone who makes it will tell you, man, they had a good support cast, you know, they're fighting alone, but they're not doing it alone. That's for sure. They're, you know, so, you know, shout out to you, you know, keep, you know.
So. I love you, bro. You're a bad motherfucker. I love you, dude. Thank you so much for coming by, man.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is open anytime to you, man. Any of your fighters, any camp, you want to help promote a fight, anything you want to do, my man, all of these microphones are open for American Top Team. They're American. They're open for anybody that you know, you guys ever need.
Gosh, I appreciate it, bro. I'm going to take you up on that offer. So I enjoyed it. It's my first one. And
you killed it, bro.
I might have been talking a little fast, but I definitely enjoyed it.
No, you'll kill the people who get by the folding of the paper and the microphone. The constant in the background. Did you like the mantra?
Oh yeah.
Did you see that shit? Did you read that? That's badass.
Yeah.
Andrew Mariani sent that up with this. He actually sent me this coffee cup, the Get Shit Done coffee cup, and he sent me that slogan in that card. I thought, that is badass.
Yeah.
I put that there, man. So then I'll leave on purpose so everybody can read that before you get going.
Yeah, I'm digging it for sure.
Yeah, man. Well, dude, thank you. Love you lots, man.
Appreciate it, man. See you guys soon.